You're listening to 340B Unscripted.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. I'm Greg Wilson and I'm here with my co-host, Rob Nahoopy. Hoopy, what's happening, man?
Not much. Lots of state things going on. State laws with 340B, that seems to be the hot active topic. And other than that, I mean, as the date of this recording, we're still end of March. We're trying to finish up our response for the Sustained 340B Act. So that's been fun reading through kind of what our team's putting together there. And I guess we've got till tomorrow to get that done, right?
Yeah, well, it's due April 1st, so we've collected some input from our team and also gathered some insights that some of the clients that we've worked with and have been really interested in reading what some of the other organizational groups out there, AHA, 340B Health, and others have put a lot of thought and considerations into not just the responses to the questions in the RFI, but also thoughts on the proposed provisions in the legislative draft that was circulated, the Sustained 340B Act. So we're putting together our response. We're going to get it in by the deadline. And then I'm sure, Rob, you and I will have a chance to kind of recap what our positions are on some of the different 340B program reform proposals that are being put out there.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, good work so far. And, you know, I haven't read, I heard AHA had a response. I haven't been able to track it down and read it or see it yet. Maybe it's not available publicly, but I know I talked to one of our client health systems and they said they heard AHA had a response going back. So they weren't going to submit anything. If anything, they would like to, you know, somehow support that document instead of reinventing the wheel. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, we did get a couple of questions from clients saying, hey, do you know of anybody that's created like a form letter or like, a sign-on petition? And that really didn't happen this time around. I feel like that happened maybe back when the omnibus guidance were published back in 2015, that, you know, some organizational groups kind of solicited support from, you know, covered entities. But here, you know, most of the groups that have, you know, the larger advocacy groups kind of crafted their own proposals. And I'm guessing that's because they want other stakeholders out in the 340B space to think about how to respond in based on their own unique perspectives. You've seen one covered entity, So, you know, each individual covered entity is probably going to have a little bit of a different take on all of the different elements that were outlined in the Sustained 340B Act.
Yeah, no, I agree with that for sure.
Well, in terms of news, I think the one thing that we are picking up on this week, and again, pleased to see, we've got another state that has fully passed contract pharmacy protection law. So West Virginia is now the third state that has passed a state-level law that protects the use of contract pharmacies for covered entities in that state. It's the Bill 325. It goes into effect June 6th, though similar to Arkansas and Louisiana, West Virginia now has a law in the books that will compel manufacturers to honor 340B, build to ship to arrangements in the covered entities in West Virginia. So I think we've got 22 states that have proposed or introduced laws. We've got 5 states that have had a bill clear some legislative chamber within their state legislature. So we're almost at half of the states in the union introducing or moving forward with contract pharmacy laws. Really interesting to see state level advocacy for a federal program, huh, Rob?
It really is. And we should probably note that Mississippi actually has their bill. Looks like it passed the House and it already passed the Senate. So Mississippi looks like they're poised to be number 4. So wait and see if that gets signed. I guess, you know, it has to always go to like the governor and get signed there.
Yeah. And again, I think we talked about it on the last episode, but this is all kind of in the context of the Arkansas Insurance Department winning their court case with the pharmaceutical manufacturers in the legality of being able to craft state level laws. So there's no preemption of these state level laws, according to that Eighth Circuit Court ruling. So again, that just paves the way for a lot of these bills to perhaps move forward.
Yeah, it feels like the states are learning from the PBM bills that which follow a similar pattern. It took a lot longer, it feels like, than these contract pharmacy ones seem to be moving a lot quicker. Interesting though, because simultaneously we talked on the last episode in our intro about Doris Matsui having her bill coming out in the House. Finally, super excited that hit, where it's very specific to contract pharmacy. So it feels like this is the first time, unlike PBM, where it just took forever to have any PBM. Traction on the federal level. We've got good traction with her bill in the House. And of course, the Sustained 340B Act on the Senate does have contract pharmacy provisions in there. So it feels like there's this multi-prong approach, which is nice because it feels like there's not just one path or one avenue for covered entities to get contract pharmacy 340 pricing, re-implemented or available again. And so kind of exciting to see. I almost feel like I'm curious, almost just as a, since we're kind of watching this, right? We can't really impact it significantly. We can talk about it. We can, hopefully get people to pay attention to it and talk to their representatives and senators and so forth. But kind of interested to see which one ends up being the best path, right? Does nothing happen federally? So these state state level activities become extremely important, or do we get either the House bill or the Senate bill to pass at some point? And then these state bills kind of become moot at that point.
Yep. Yeah. So again, interesting development and one that we'll continue to share our thoughts on as we see more things develop in that space. So,
yeah, I don't know about you, but I feel like even in through my pharmacy career, even when I was on our state ASHP affiliate with USHP here in Utah, and I was a board member and I worked with our advocacy chair, is Kavisha at the University of Utah. And, I spent a lot of time at this level, but I don't think I've learned more about the legislative process than I have really paying attention to it due to 340B. So really interesting. I feel like I'm more involved in politics than I ever have been.
Yeah.
Simply because it means so much to the 340B program and how the 340 program was developed. So yeah. It's been good.
Yeah. All right. Another this is maybe a hot topic that's, crept up in various conversations that we've had with clients and other folks in the 340B provider space. Rob, I wanted to bounce this off you. This is kind of like unplanned, but we've had a cluster of clients receive letters from manufacturers. Won't name the manufacturers, but this has happened in the past. I feel like we've got another kind of like swell of these inquiries that are coming to 340B providers from the manufacturers, or maybe from a third party that's representing manufacturers, saying, look, hey, we've got this cohort of data around your 340B purchase activities, and we want to gather some information. We're worried about potential stacked rebates or duplicate discounts. We want you to respond to our request for information around how you're buying 340B drugs. So flurry of these letters coming in, and covered entities are asking, what's our obligation to respond, or how would you suggest we approach the receipt of these letters from manufacturers? Rob, what's your take on addressing these good faith inquiries, if we're calling them good faith inquiries?
Yeah, I mean, typically my first approach is to determine if it's a good faith inquiry, right? Sometimes it's they have a good faith inquiry being that they have reasonable suspicion or reasonable cause to ask the question. And sometimes if the letter or the request doesn't say it's a good faith inquiry, I do recommend checking, hey, is this an official good faith inquiry from a manufacturer, especially if it's a vendor like a Calderos or one of the other companies representing manufacturers. And just determining that first, right? Because there is an expectation from HRSA that if a manufacturer has a good faith inquiry because they have some data to back up that there might be some diversion or duplicate discount or some other a GPO prohibition violation or whatever the case may be, that there is an expectation that covered entities do respond. Now, the repercussions if you don't respond are the manufacturer could at some point then request, with absence of a response, the manufacturer could request HRSA give them approval to do a covered entity audit, a 340B audit,
yep.
Not of your whole program like Bizzell would, but likely specific to the whatever issue they have. And so in a lot of covered entities, sometimes we'll kind of push the boundary there just because they're busy and some of these inquiries are very time consuming. But my recommendation is, looking at the inquiry, does it make sense? Is it something that you can reasonably look up that's not going to be excessive from your time frame? And just determine if there's any, if if there's any truth to the request they're asking, and respond if you can, because a lot of times it is going to be duplicate discount related or it's going to be diversion related, right? But sometimes a manufacturer will just almost send the same letter out to everybody. And then I kind of question, is that actually a good faith inquiry or is that just a shotgun, right? They're just spamming everybody with a letter and hoping that they get some decrease in 340B purchasing. I think we've seen that with some injectable products that are specific to a hospital setting, a mixed use setting, where they felt, oh gosh, we feel like there should be more inpatient use there for more GPO purchases, and you primarily have 340B purchases. Therefore, we think you're diverting. But they don't really have data to back that up necessarily, other than that they're buying primarily on a 340B account. And again, there's some of these drugs, it's like, well, it makes sense the way that's used. Yeah. I don't want to throw any manufacturers specifically on the bus, but it could be something that's used in the ER primarily, right? Especially because there's times of the essence. And so almost all of it's going to be outpatient because it's going to be given in an ER setting.
Or in outpatient ambulatory areas where maybe you operate a clean site and you only buy your drugs for that department on a 340B account. It's reasonable that you wouldn't have GPO purchases or WAC purchases if you're a dish covered entity if it that drug is exclusively used in an outpatient location. And sometimes that's the nature of the question. Hey, we noticed for this period of time, you only made this purchase on a 340B account. That may not be a problem if, you know, again, that's a location that's, you know, servicing exclusively outpatient or clean site types of 340B activity. So,
yeah, because we've seen those, right? Oh, we don't see a WAC purchase. It's like, well, WAC purchases are only required for mixed use or, you know, neutral inventories. If you're prospectively buying, there's actually not a requirement. And but that's probably a tidbit. I still hear that from covered NAs. Oh, we've got to do that WAC purchase for that clean set. I'm like, no, you don't. Not if you're prospectively storing it and calling it 340B. It's only when you're going to store it in a mixed use area and you don't know if the patient who's going to receive it's going to be an inpatient or an outpatient, then you have to buy it on WAC because you cannot buy it prospectively, buy a 340B drug and give it to an inpatient. So that's what that expectation comes from. But we do hear sometimes, no, all our drugs we buy on 340, we have to have a WAC initial purchase. And it's a good reminder, that's not actually true if it's a outpatient only area that's carving in Medicaid. So it's all patients qualify for 340B. You can actually buy that on 340B up front in those prospective situations.
Another question that comes up too is, you know, sometimes these inquiries, that there's no limit to the scope of what they're asking for in terms of data review. Rob, what are your thoughts on kind of establishing some parameters or trying to negotiate some boundaries around what the look back might be?
Yeah, well, one that we quite frequently use is the 3-year look back, right? There's some documentation in the Federal Register from HRSA about 3 years being the minimum record retention requirement. And so, you know, for us, we recommend that to be in policy for our clients. And so we definitely do push back when these good faith inquiries try and go back more than 3 years, which I think is excessive, right? It's hard to start collecting data. It's even hard to know what occurred back then. So we definitely limit things for up to 3 years. And you know, in many cases, whatever the issue is, it's not even going back that far. But if someone is trying to go back much further than 3 years, I would push back on that and say, hey, look, we've got to limit this inquiry. I mean, try and go shorter if you can. Let's kind of stick to something that we can actually investigate and still have good data and recollection on there. So, but that's, you know, the nice part I'd say is it's a conversation, right? It's, you know, manufacturers are asking something or their vendors asking something. Have a conversation with them about what, hey, you know, that's a lot. Can we start with this? Let's see if there's even an issue before we go and spend hours and hours trying to dig up and find all this data. We've changed EHRs, we've changed TPAs. It's just not that easy to go back, you know, a significant amount of time. So, but have a conversation, right? I think I've worked with a lot of the manufacturers and a lot of them are good to work with. They'll have a conversation with you about it. You know, they're just trying to make sure that things are being done correctly on their side as well.
Yeah. All right. Appreciate your feedback on that. We've had, again, kind of cluster of those questions coming up. So hopefully that feedback, that info is helpful for those of you out there that are kind of, you know, grappling with some of those letters coming in. This week's episode, a little spin on what we've been doing. So, Rob, we've been recording a series of episodes related to the HRSA data request list. And you and I both primarily are coming from hospital pharmacy backgrounds. But, you know, there are some nuances to the data that HRSA asks for audits that are specific to grantee covered entities. So Jasmine and Megan from our team, they're going to take over the podcast this week and share some insights from their perspectives working with different types of grantee clients, including Ryan White Clinic, CHCs, FQHCs. So lots of good, I think, anecdotes from those two that we're going to have them share with you guys this week. And I know you and I have to round out the DRL topic. We got to come back, talk about Section 8, which is disclosures, and the big one, 9, which is Medicaid detail.
Medicaid. Yeah, that'll be a good one. And disclosure will be quick, but you know, there's some things people should be aware of with disclosures, especially if you had a HRSA with disclosures, and typically that's within, since you received that letter, but yeah, Medicaid will be a big one. I'm kind of excited. I haven't heard the recording yet. The first time that we're going to have a podcast core episode where you or I haven't been on it.
Yeah. So, leap of faith here. We told them it's got to be unscripted. I'm sure they did a good job. So, you know, they've got, you know, I think we've got 45 minutes of chatter around grantee focused topics. So for those out in the in our audience group here that are grantee focused, I hope you enjoy Jasmine and Megan sharing some insights. So we're going to take a quick break. On the other side, we'll have Jasmine and Megan sharing their thoughts on HRSA audits.
Sounds good.
The 340B Unscripted podcast is brought to you by SpendBend Pharmacy. Do you wish you had another 340B expert on your team to help you manage your 340B program, but there's no time or budget available to hire an FTE? The SpendBend Pharmacy 340B staff augmentation solution provides you with an industry expert to help manage your 340B compliance tasks. Visit spendbend.com and follow the pharmacy links to learn how you can maximize your 340B efforts.
Hey everyone, this is Jasmine from SpendMend, and last time I was here, we talked a lot about differences with clinics and grantees and what they're dealing with operationally, and I'm so lucky to have Megan here today with me again. But Megan, I think you need a redo of your introduction, because last time Rob totally threw you under the bus. So can you give us a little bit of the background about yourself?
Yes, thank you. When my mom listened to the podcast, she did say that Rob really kind of was razzing me and didn't give me the introduction I deserved. So for everyone out there who hasn't met me, I feel like I've met everyone at this point, but I'm one of the OG turnkey members. So maybe that's another reason why Rob forgot to give an intro to me. But I have been involved in 340B for quite a long time now. It might age me out if I give that number. But I started working with a large FQHC in Philadelphia, where we were approached at our specialty pharmacy to start a contract pharmacy for them. So at this point, we had no idea what 340B was. My bosses didn't. So during my maternity leave, myself and two of my mentors put our heads together and started the company's first contract pharmacy. So I managed that for about 10 years. And then the FQHC said, Megan, why don't you come on over and help us? Because at this point, we don't have a 340B oversight team. So I went to work with them and became their 340B compliance director and one of their clinical pharmacists. So I did that for around 6 years. And this is where I met Rob, met him at one of the many APEXIS trainings where I heard him speak and asked him to come and perform our internal audit. So we became fast friends, and at one of the coalitions, he asked me to join the turnkey team. And so it's been history from there. So I always like to tell my clients is that I've been in their shoes and understand having to wear multiple hats in the 340B world. So I think that's probably a good way to segue into, you know, why you and I are here today, Jasmine. So Rob and Greg asked us to do a little takeover so we could speak to the nuances of the grantees, the health centers, in regard to the data requests that we would see in an actual HRSA audit.
Yeah, thank you for that, Megan. Such good experience and really from the ground up. And so long-term experience in 340B that you don't see very often. So we're so lucky to have you on our team, Megan.
We're luckier to have you, Jasmine.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so we're going to really set the stage today on why it's important to understand the HRSA data request list? And how do you meet some of these requests? Because some of them might be a little bit confusing. There's a lot of resources in the industry that focus on hospitals, but not as many resources that really provide support for clinics, health centers, and grantees. And so I'm going to throw out just a few statistics. And so HRSA does audits of covered entities every year, and they try to shoot for about 200 audits a year. They're usually really on target with that 200 number, maybe a few under that. And there's a program integrity page on the HRSA 340B website that will publicly post all of the HRSA audits and their findings. So it's almost a little bit of shaming, it feels like, if you get a HRSA audit
the 340B
finding.
Wall of shame, yes.
Exactly. So you want to try to get on there with no findings, right? But it really helps us get a little bit of visibility into what HRSA considers important, what types of findings they're issuing, how do we mitigate the risks for these types of findings. And so for 2023, as of today, I checked the website and saw that there were 138 audit results that were posted. So we're still missing just over 30% of audit results for 2023, right? And I think that is probably because of a lot of ongoing litigation in HRSA, you know, a lot of challenges to HRSA's oversight authority. So there might be some extra review that's going on for some of these audits that are still outstanding. But of the 138 audits on the program integrity page, only 24 of those 138 were actually for clinics and grantees. So that's about 17% of all of the audits that were conducted in 2023 that were posted so far were for clinics and grantees. So it means a lot of the focus is on hospitals, right? But that doesn't mean that as a clinic and a grantee, you shouldn't take this seriously, because some of the findings really could have a large impact on your 340B program, right? Hospitals, when we think about these large hospital systems, their savings are exponentially greater than what a lot of the clinics are saving using the 340B program. So even some minor, what would be considered a minor finding and some repayments to manufacturers, you know, might end up being a big chunk of your overall savings as a clinic and grantee. So just because there's fewer audits really doesn't mean that it shouldn't be taken seriously. And we've had clients that have been small clinics or grantees, or even very large clinics and grantees that have been audited. So your size doesn't always mean that you're gonna not get picked. Really, those out of the 17%, so out of the 24 clinics and grantees that were audited, only 11 had findings. So less than 50% of the clinics and grantees that were audited had findings. But it's still a pretty big percentage of findings, right? If you're saying, okay, maybe like 40% of all of the clinics and grantees that are being audited are having findings posted, right? And presumably the ones that haven't been posted yet are still under review because they might have some findings, right? And, you know, when we're thinking in the context of clinics and grantees, they have so many unique scenarios that you almost can't find information on HRSA's website to guide these clinics and grantees through these scenarios, right? There's a lot of unknowns when it comes to how do you manage your program in a way that's HRSA compliant? Because I say this to my clients quite a bit, and I wish I didn't have to, but with a HRSA audit, you almost don't know you're going to get a finding until it's a finding in terms of new types of findings, right? So we know duplicate discount findings, you know, diversion findings, things like that. But sometimes we're surprised by the types of findings, right, that come out all of a sudden. And it's not like HRSA posts a manual at the beginning of the fiscal year to say, hey, guys, these are all the requirements. This is exactly what we're going to audit against. If you don't meet these requirements, you're going to get a finding. You might think you're compliant, and then you get hit with right, a finding that you were surprised by. And it's happened to us before as well. And we always, I'm going to put a kind of a disclaimer out there. We always recommend trying to appeal certain findings, right? So if you end up with a finding, it might be worth looking into appealing it if you really disagree with it. So we always encourage having your HRSA audit reviewed by someone and see if there's an opportunity for an appeal there. Because there have been some that we feel like could have been appealed and maybe didn't have the support to appeal those findings. All right, so Megan, I think this is a really good place to start digging into the data request. And the very first item is policies and procedures. And this is probably one of the most important items in terms of setting the stage for how HRSA is going to audit your program, because this is where you tell them, this is how we run our program.
Absolutely. And I feel like this piece is almost like an open book test. If you go on a PEXIS, you can find the data request. For request number one, it will give you all the elements that you need to cover, all the elements that you need to have language pertaining to in your policy procedure. You'll find policies on a PEXIS if you don't have one. We don't want you to reinvent the wheel, right? So there's policies about health centers, policies for hemophilia, and policies for family planning. Unfortunately, there aren't policies on a PEXIS's website for the Ryan White grantees or the STD grantees, but we're always to happy to help you add language that helps kind of tie in those grantee types to our templates that applies to the health centers. So they're easily adjustable. One of the things that you have to make sure you do when you have a template is make sure it actually follows your practice. The worst thing is to hand in a template that you have not customized. So one of the pieces that we see with policy is typically not receiving a finding, you're receiving an area for improvement. So an AFI. So this does not go on the wall of shame as we mentioned before. But that leans into, you could have the best policy, but if you don't practice it at your organization, and let's say you receive a finding for a duplicate discount, you will also most likely receive an area for improvement with your policy. So again, open book test, make sure you have all those elements that they require. If you're looking for a template, that you can find some online, or feel free to reach out to us. One of the pieces I just want to add before we go to the next data request element is, in 2023, the call out was contract pharmacy. Now the call out on preventing diversion or eligibility applies to all pharmacies. So I think that's an important piece for all covered entities to realize.
Yeah, absolutely, Megan. Good point. You know, policies are really not a set it and forget it document, right? You have to be constantly reviewing, you know, I would recommend annually, just to validate that HRSA hasn't added or changed any of their policy requests, right? So as you noted, you know, for example, this year, they are now requesting policies related to all of your pharmacies, not just the covered entity, not just contract pharmacy. They want to know about entity-owned in-house retail pharmacies or other pharmacies that HRSA would consider in the audit. So really important to sit down with your oversight committee and reevaluate your policies. Have we actually changed any of our practices during this year that we might want to go into our policy and update? Because HRSA will hold you accountable to this policy. The good news is that you will receive areas for improvements, AFIs, as opposed to a finding related to policy. But it really gives you kind of a little bit of a buffer, a little bit of safety if you're able to formulate your policies in a way that makes it general enough that gives you some flexibility, but also specific enough to meet the HRSA requirements, right? So not giving more than you need to, exactly, but giving you some protections.
Yes.
All right.
And then, so number two on our data request, and Greg and Rob went into this for the hospital. It's what your eligibility documents are. So the guys touched on that more on the other podcast. So we'll talk about what's the requirement for the grantee types. So starting with 2A, they ask you for a listing of locations where health services are provided. So it is an easy ask. You can really just go into the OPACE database and perform an extraction, and then just take that information, throw it into an Excel. But what you will need to do is include a column that references your EHR code or your shorthand code. And so a lot of clients will ask us, what does this really mean? And what HRSA wants to be able to understand is once they're looking in your EHR, they want to see where that patient was seen. So they want to see that eligible location, and they don't want to have to try to figure out when you're talking and you know your organization and you might say your own shorthands, they want to have that going in to the audit. So that's the first piece. And then the second piece is a notice of a grant or information about your subgrantee documentation. Prior to, I guess I would say maybe a year ago, in HRSA audits, they were not asking for actual notice of award, in my experience with my clients, and they were really just looking at the EHB. So in November 2023 audit, worked with a client, they had all their ducks in a row, we were absolutely ready, game time, and they threw out, all right, we need your notice of grant. Of course they had it, but we didn't have that at our fingertips. So you want to make sure you have that. You want to make sure you have your up-to-date notice of grant award that covers that time period. For Ryan White's, perhaps you're a sub-grantee. You want to make sure you have that documentation. For STD sites, typically you don't have a direct contract. So you're working with the health department. So you want to make sure you have that documentation. Perhaps you just have an email. You really want to make sure you reach out to that entity that you're working with that's providing you eligibility and have that ready to go. Any other pieces that I'm missing, Jasmine?
Yeah, I think another common one we see are IHS compact agreements. So tribal health, Indian health services, clinics that are really considered FQHCs by CMS, right? And we'll go into a little bit more discussion about why that specific comment is relevant a little bit later. But they have separate compact agreements, IHS compact, 638 compact agreements that should be ready to go for HRSA audits as well. So each different grantee type might have slightly different types of compact agreements, sub-grantee agreements, notice of funding award agreements. So really the message here is you want to be sure that you have those documents and the current documents, right, that cover the existing period of eligibility to demonstrate to HRSA that you are an eligible 340B entity. So there's lots of different categories of grantees, lots of different documents there, and we'd be happy to help you figure out what those documents are. But really the message is making sure that you're doing the due diligence to have those documents ready to go. And then circling back to 2A, Megan, you did such a good job of describing why this is important. And I just wanted to add, you know, it's really a completeness test is why they're asking for that EHR column, right? Because they want to be able to look at your utilization data and not have to guess which location matches which 340B registration. And they also want to see, do you have data for all of the locations as we would expect to have, right? If all of a sudden you have 10 locations registered, but you only have utilization for 5, that might lead to some questions in terms of why we're not seeing utilization at those locations. And the simple answer might be, well, we don't do provider administered drugs at that location, or we don't do contract pharmacy prescribers out of that location, right? But it really helps HRSA get a better picture of what they should expect in your data. which kind of leads right into the next discussion about auditable records, which we've talked about. Megan, you and I have talked about auditable records. I think we've gone in circles. That's how much we've talked about it.
Yes.
Last time we were on the podcast, we did a pretty big segment about auditable records and some of the challenges that we see in clinics and grantees. So I think it's good to circle back and touch on them again. Really highlight some of the differences between clinics, grantees versus hospitals and why we see those challenges. And auditable records are probably, you know, I said policies were important, but auditable records are just an absolute pinnacle requirement of 340B, right? It's actually an eligibility requirement. So if you don't provide auditable records, you could lose eligibility for your 340B program. So this is a very serious data request to make sure that you are prepared to meet this data request.
Right. And so, and that's sectioned into 3A. And so A is requesting a narrative describing the methodology, really how your reports were gathered, if there were any limitations, whether in your claim data you have reversals. So it's really just a description. Again, they don't want to guess about your data. And then that really takes us right into 3B, which is provide a crosswalk to describe each column header in the universe, the data universe you provide. I wish that HRSA would just say, provide us with a key. When you say a key, that kind of just, all right, I get it now. Because each report is different. So they want to know where acquisition cost is or where they'll find NDC versus drug. So we have explanations for that. I feel like that's one of the asks that's easier. Once you see it, you say, oh, now I get what they're looking for. And a lot of the TPAs will provide that key for you. So you don't have to put that together for yourself. But so 3AB, we're talking about auditable records, really the explanation so HRSA knows what they're looking at with your data.
Yeah, 3B is kind of one of those, a little bit of a nuisance request, right?
Yes.
Because you're like, oh gosh, why do, it says patient ID, why do I have to describe this? And in some circumstances, the headers are relatively obvious in terms of what their the intention is or the description is, right? But in other cases, it could be a little bit confusing. So being able to map out, here are all of the HRSA requested data elements. Here is how, you know, this TPA report meets these data requests, you know, and what their headers are mapped to the HRSA data request elements. So I agree with you. I think a key, you know, a legend, something that really just maps out all of those different data headers. And we've seen a lot of TPAs have really stepped up here to provide entities with the glossary of terms or whatever they call it in their reports, that you'll have typically a separate worksheet when you run the reports of utilization that includes that key or that crosswalk for you, which is great. If they don't provide it, you can build your own. So we have some templates that we can provide as well, but it's one of those requests that it's great if you just get it done, ready for HRSA audit. That way you eliminate that back and forth with the HRSA auditor on that.
Absolutely. And then 3C is it's basically your data, but they have the elements that they want you to include. And I won't go through all those pieces to save time, but I think this is where we see the nuances for provider-administered drugs. So they're asking for the NDC acquisition price. And if you're a clinic and you're maintaining your auditable records on paper logs, you know, how do we get that to HRSA? And, you know, maybe you talk about that in your pre-audit call and say, well, at our clinic, we manage everything via paper. So would you like us to upload our, you know, many, many logs, or just, you know, talk to them about how you want to reconcile that. But it is the utmost importance to have these auditable records. And Jazz, I think you can speak to in the past, working with a client that we did an audit, made the recommendation, you don't have records for your clinic administered drugs. And then lo and behold, they have a HRSA audit and, you know, tried to reconcile that. And it turned out to only be around $6,000 or maybe even less worth of provider administered drugs. But, you know, they almost lost their 340B eligibility over it.
Yeah, and this is an exact example of where I was kind of shocked at HRSA's response, right? I felt that they lacked a little bit of grace for this poor covered entity who had such a low volume of affected provider-administered drugs where they were lacking some records, right? And really, it's a matter of, okay, we have it documented in the medical record, right? We're right. pretty confident that our providers are documenting their healthcare services in the medical record, but sometimes they're not documenting it in a place that is easy to query, right? So if it's not in a structured field that can be queried, it makes it really difficult to pull those records out of the EHR. And now you're left with a situation where you've used 340B inventory. The documentation is living somewhere in your medical record and you're having trouble retrieving it, right? So this is where, you know, and when you talk about a clinic, FQHC setting, grantee setting, we don't deal with inpatient versus outpatient, right? We don't have departments necessarily that are ineligible, right? It's the location itself is registered. If a patient walks through the door and they get care from that provider, that patient is technically eligible, right? So it becomes a difficult situation for clinics and grantees because they typically have less advanced technology than hospitals. They're not doing barcode scanning. You know, they have a lot more staff turnover or difficulty with documentation and less informatics, you know, teams. You know, they might not have as much support from a tech team to be able to build out these data queries. They're relying on paper logs. There's a whole host of reasons why this is more of a challenge for clinics and grantees. And I wish that HRSA would provide maybe a little bit of a threshold of grace, right? Because really, unless someone is taking drugs off of the shelf and stealing them, there isn't really going to be a scenario of diversion. Now, you could get into, okay, if they're carve in versus carve out, that becomes sure. a little bit more challenging with Medicaid. And now you have to track what you're giving to each patient because we're carved out, right? But in the sense of just patient eligibility, if they're walking through your door, they're probably eligible, right? So it's something.
Right. So the information is there. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, sometimes difficult to data mine or, you know, maybe the clinic doesn't have the newest level of Epic. They're right. like, no, we're not able to do this reporting. So it definitely makes that ask more difficult and HRSA would like it in Excel format.
Right.
But to your point, we're really stretching our federal funds here and they just don't go into getting the fanciest EHR that's out there.
Right, exactly. And this is where you can, I do not recommend disclosing to HRSA that you have trouble with your auditable records, right? Necessarily. You might want to work with them on, hey, we can't provide this specific field, right? That our EHR doesn't have the ability to pull this specific field. And that would be one of the limitations you would include. But I think you work as hard as you can to provide as many auditable records. And this is why your self audits are so crucial, because then you can really see and spot check. Do we have really massive discrepancies in what we're purchasing versus what we're showing as documented administrations? And then work with your informatics team to figure out how they're pulling the data, right? Because that could really affect your reports as well in terms of, are they pulling administration records or are they pulling from billing charges? Because not everything is billed, so you might be missing out a big chunk of those utilizations. Work with them to validate that you have your drug catalog or your drug library drop-down options consistent with what you're purchasing so that providers can even document those drug administrations, right? Because if you're not maintaining that drug catalog in your EHR and they don't have a drop-down option for that drug, they're probably not going to document it in that query, that structured field, right? They're going to document it somewhere else because they are frustrated that they don't have this field, or they're going to pick a totally different drug, right? And just to have something documented. And that's a whole different issue. So the biggest recommendation here is just really try to work with your billing department, your clinical staff on training, and your informatics team, your EHR team, to make sure that we're bridging the gap as much as possible for those records.
Yes, absolutely. And then, so we can just move on to number four, which is the request for a provider list. So, you know, this is going to, I'm sure Greg and Rob touch on this, and it's basically the same for the health centers and grantee types, that you need to provide a list of your active providers. But then they want a start and term date, so maybe not active, but more of a perpetual list of your providers, and then be prepared to show the auditor proof of employment, contract, or credentialing. So, you know, that list is so important to maintain for your HRSA audit, but also for your TPAs, for your in-house pharmacy, for eligibility. For those eligible providers when you're looking at you know, how you're qualifying claims. But what I will say is one of the nuances that I came across in actual HRSA audit was again this site that I was mentioning that on target, ready to go for their HRSA audit. They were in a big city and they had residents. And you know what they had ready for the HRSA auditor was an overarching contract between the FQHC and the hospital that applied to all the residents. Well, this HRSA auditor in particular asked for, they wanted that contract between that resident and the hospital. So I think we had at least 17 unique providers that were either residents, or they were nurse practitioners or PAs. And this HRSA auditor also wanted collaborative practices for those. So that took us an additional hour to contact hospitals, work with human resources to get these additional elements. So that's one kind of pause for concern. If you're at FQHC or the other grantee types and you work with residents, be prepared that you might have to submit that information. And I think that's also a good way in your pre-audit call to kind of go over with the HRSA auditors or the Bazell auditors. They're great to work with. I think they're great with clarifying questions on that pre-audit call. So take that time to ask all those difficult questions and maybe show them what you plan on presenting if that's suitable.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even thinking about some of the other grantee types who don't have providers on site and they're relying on MOUs with other entities, you know, that are the healthcare providers, right? So Ryan White comes to mind in terms of relying on MOUs if you're doing more
case management.
Exactly. Yeah. So being prepared to notify any of the other entities that you have relationships with that you are going to be undergoing a HRSA audit so that you can get copies, obtain copies of documents if you don't have them on hand yourself. So important to really work with any of your partners to notify them of the upcoming audits because it really does come down to a time crunch.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening to the podcast. Megan and Jasmine had such great feedback and so many insights around their perspective around the data request list, we couldn't squeeze it all into a single episode. So those two will be back next week for a bonus episode where they'll continue with part two of their review of HRSA's data request list. Thanks again for listening. Take care.
Thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.